irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland. I'm a psychoanalyst specializing in food, weight, and body image issues, and I'm here to help you stop binging, stop thinking about food all the time, and find peace. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health all without ever going on another diet. So last week, I got all fired up when one of my regular callers, Larry from Burbank, called in to ask me some questions about sugar addiction and the impact of sugar on the brain and how sugar is addictive and all of that. I didn't have time to fully explore it with Larry, so I'm devoting this entire show to the topic because it's an important one. There's so much misinformation out there, and I want you guys to really get the truth. So let me just dive in. The question is food addiction real? Now let me tell you, in my clinical experience, everyone who seeks treatment for binge eating or compulsive eating or some kind of unhealthy, unhappy overeating believes the problem is food. They call themselves chocoholics or foodaholics. They are afraid they're always going to struggle with what they call an addiction to food. Many of them say they never eat sugar or white flour. They think the only way to stay clean, as they put it, is to avoid all problematic or forbidden foods. Now, what happens? Inevitably, their willpower fails, they binge, they overeat, which leads to intense feelings of shame and self-recrimination. And if food is the thing that they choose to comfort themselves or it's what works, then it leads to this horrible cycle of binging and feeling bad about yourself and binging. But is food addiction valid? So in the last few years, there's been a lot of media coverage on this topic, especially with respect to sugar. In fact, I posted a month or two ago, I posted in a Facebook group that when it comes to binge eating, psychological triggers are far more influential than food. And one person responded, and most irately, or so I read it, she said, quote, "It's a proven fact now that for some people, they react to sugar the same way as heroin addicts react in their brain. You would never tell a heroin addict just to have a little bit or an alcoholic just to have a little bit. And what is alcohol but sugar?" Well, you know, I'm going to get to that so-called proven fact in a second. But, you know, she is not alone in this idea that sugar and heroin are equivalent. Lately, it seems like the idea of sugar addiction is totally accepted by the general public as scientifically factual. In fact, I've spoken to people who report that they never eat sugar. They maintain what they call abstinence in order to, as they put it, detox from sugar. They believe they can detoxify their bodies from sugar and that the only way to stay clean is to avoid all sugar. This notion of detoxification is also completely false, since any food you eat, even pure protein, even something with almost no carbs or no carbs, can be turned into sugar in your body through the process of gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis. It is a biochemical process that results in glucose being generated from non-carbohydrate foods. Now, you don't hear so much about gluconeogenesis, do you? I kind of like saying it, though, so you might be hearing more. Gluconeogenesis. It's like crying out for a song or something. All right. You do not hear about gluconeogenesis. You hear things like Oh, sugar is deadly, which is the premise of a lot of recent bestsellers, like notably one called The Case Against Sugar, written by Gary Taubes. By the way, he's a journalist, not a biochemist, not a neurobiologist, no degree in any kind of science, but he's done a lot of research, and he says that sugar is the principal cause of obesity, diabetes, coronary heart disease, and many other fatal diseases. In fact, let me just say what the theory of food addiction is before I go on. So the theory of food addiction is basically it correlates specific foods with increased dopamine levels in your brain. So dopamine is the chemical that mediates pleasure and motivation in our brains. So the theory is that sugar and other foods activate the release of dopamine. You eat sugar, for example, or you eat something, you get a dopamine rush, you feel better, you feel good, and then you have to eat increasing amounts to get the same experience that you previously had with less. So, but food addiction theory essentially points to these changes in the brain, specifically higher levels of dopamine, as evidence of substance addiction. And you know, when you look at the book The Case Against Sugar, and you hear about these studies with the dopamine, you know, it sounds pretty good. It's very convincing. But other studies from the fields of neurology and obesity research have come to very different conclusions. They say that there is little evidence to support the idea of food as physiologically addictive. And this includes sugar, which is the substance most often labeled as addictive. Nutrition researcher Dr. Stéphane Guyonnet, who is a neurobiologist, he says, and I quote, "Obesity and non-communicable diseases are multiply determined, with refined sugar playing a role among other things like excess calorie intake, physical inactivity, cigarette smoking, alcohol, drug use, and various other diet and lifestyle factors." He further notes that these diseases are not all correlated with sugar intake. And here's the really interesting thing. He says that sugar intake has actually been declining in the past two decades, yet in the same period of time, both obesity and diabetes rates have dramatically increased. So even though sugar intake has been on the decline, these diseases are on the upswing. So we can't correlate everything just to sugar. And again, Dr. Stéphane Guyonnet has a doctorate. He is a neurobiologist. Gary Taubes is a journalist. Draw your own conclusions. So here's the thing. Sugar does change our brains. There is no question of that. Spending time with friends, playing games, shopping, and any other pleasurable activity also raises the dopamine levels in our brains. In fact, one study proved that listening to classical music has the same impact on our brains as cocaine. But our brains also react differently to sugar than to drugs like cocaine or heroin. So in research studies with rodents, rats, who were given cocaine, their dopamine levels surged but did not return to baseline. They needed more and more of the drug to maintain their baseline dopamine levels. And that is not what happens when we eat sugar or any other so-called addictive food. When we eat sugar or anything else, our dopamine levels do rise, but then they return to a baseline level and stay consistent. And let me just take a moment to talk about rats. Okay, so most of these studies are done on rats, and then it's extrapolated or generalized to us as human beings. Now, Rachel Hartley, who is a registered dietitian who writes about food and nutrition, she says rat studies are kind of dumb. In fact, that's an actual quote. Rat studies are kind of dumb. She says one of the big arguments for sugar addiction is rat studies show more addictive and drug-seeking behaviors for sugar than for illicit drugs, including cocaine, heroin, and crystal meth. And she has a couple of problems with these studies, as do I. First off, we are humans, not rats. Both physically and psychologically, we are a different species. Species? Species? I'm not sure which is right. I think they're both right. Anyway, so remember, rats' primary concern in life is survival. And their survival is highly dependent on finding food in any form. She says, hey, remember Templeton from Charlotte's Web or Ratatouille, if you saw that movie? Look, rats are just trying to stay alive. They're interested in survival. Rats don't deal with peer pressure. Rats don't have childhood trauma that causes them to reach for food or other things to numb their emotions or distract themselves. Rats want food, and sugar is food. So, of course, they choose sugar over drugs. That's their primal drive kicking in. Also, These studies show rats displaying addictive and drug-seeking behavior when they're given intermittent access to sugar. And this is so important because it actually confirms what we know about people and sugar. When you take something away, as in go on a diet, you totally obsess over it, feel a craving, and then you overconsume it, binging. That's the anticipation or the experience of deprivation leading to having more of it when it's available. So, you know, this whole sugar being more addictive than drugs metaphor is just not the case. Rachel Hartley says if people really think that sugar is more addictive than drugs, we should probably need to start arresting grocery store managers for drug trafficking. She's cute. And she also says there are a lot of things that trigger the addiction pathway. So, drugs release a flood of feel-good hormones like dopamine, which triggers the part of the brain that's responsible for reward, which is also triggered by sugar, but a lot of other things. She says naps, exercise, sex, connection with others, and all food, not just food, that breaks down immediately into sugar. She says that she read a study that showed that even couples who've been happily married for years get a flood of dopamine when they're shown pictures of their exes. She says, if science tells me I get a flood of dopamine whenever I see a picture of an ex-boyfriend, so be it. But I can tell you for damn sure, I am not addicted to them. She says, if sugar and other food didn't trigger the dopamine reward cycle, we wouldn't be alive today. Prehistoric humans would have starved to death, and Earth would probably be ruled by rats. She also says, if sugar was addictive, you would get an equal high from bananas and yogurt. Many foods are naturally rich in sugar, fruits, dairy. If sugar was truly addicted, then it would also include these foods, which can be equal in sugar content to other kinds of sweets. But I don't think you ever hear of people binging on cantaloupe or bananas, you know, because these foods aren't placed off limits, which then triggers it triggers the wish to eat more of it. And there's the connection between our minds, the anticipation of deprivation or deprivation, and how that triggers binging. There is no question that the primary cause of binging is not being triggered by the people think it's whatever they're eating, but it's some situation that's making them want to eat. And sometimes that can happen so fast, you don't even realize it's happening. So binge eating decreases when you're given access to forbidden foods. When people are told, hey, eat this forbidden food, what generally happens? People eat less of it. And I have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who's this?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I was dialing Dr. Nina for webinar.
Oh, no, this is my radio show, and this is Dr. Nina. How can I help you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm sorry to bother you. I had an email from you, and it said that join us at 10 o'clock.
Oh, for my radio show.
LA Talk Great.
Yeah.
Army?
Yeah, that's what that. And you called LA Talk Radio. You're on the air with me. It's just between us.
Oh my God!
I apologize.
I'm glad I got to say hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'll go on the webinar then with you. I'm sorry to bother you. Have a great day.
No, wait. There's no webinar.
Oh.
There's no webinar. It's just my radio show, and then you can listen to it later on iTunes. But since you're talking to me, it's just the two of us. What's your name?
Jody.
Jody,
did
you have a question for me that I could answer?
A question I would have is I've been a sugar addict all my life, and I've tried everything to stop eating sugar, and I have not been successful. Luckily, I'm very healthy, but I would like to kick the habit, and I have not, as of yet, been successful. Any suggestions?
Well, and I've been. When we get off the air, you'll later on you can listen to the beginning of the show, in which I talk about how sugar addiction. It sure feels like an addiction, but it is biochemically actually not an addiction. If anything, it is an addiction to using food to resolve something inside. And sometimes, but it feels, I get that it totally feels like a biochemical thing and you're addicted to it. But one of the things that I was just saying when you called was that it's telling yourself you can't have something that makes you want it. When you figure out what sugar is doing for you, and by the way, people don't generally eat spoonfuls of sugar, right? It's not like if sugar was really addictive, people would just be, you know, eating granular sugar. It's always something. It's always sugar in some kind of food, right?
Yes.
And it's different when it's sugar in, say, ice cream, because that is correlated with a need for comfort. If it's sugar in cakes and muffins and things that are kind of bulky, that is associated with filling a void or loneliness or some kind of emptiness. And if it's sugar that is involved in something crunchy like chocolate-covered pretzels, that's associated with anger, which anger is sort of a broad term, frustration, annoyance, you know, other things. Often people don't allow themselves to get angry at, especially women, in situations in their lives, but they sure can get angry at themselves for eating something that they don't want to eat. So which of those three categories fits you?
Ice cream.
So when I make the correlation between ice cream and needing to and a wish for comfort and soothing, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, it's stress. I usually eat sugar when I'm stressed out. You know, I grab for sugar.
Right. So let me ask you something. If a friend of yours said she was really stressed out, oh, it's a hard day, everything's tough, would you say, here, have some ice cream?
No, definitely not.
What would you say?
I would say, let's sit down and talk about it.
Yeah. And would you offer, like, listen to her, and you'd want to know what she was feeling and thinking, and you'd use soothing words, right?
Yeah, I would just have a conversation with her and let her use me as a sounding board to voice her feelings, and maybe we could get at the feelings underneath the need for sugar.
Exactly. So you have to start being that friend that you are to others, to yourself. Ultimately, when we give ourselves comfort words and we are soothing and comforting and supportive of ourselves in a way that feels good, And it takes practice, because at first it's like, why would I talk to myself when I can eat that ice cream? But with which I've heard more than once, oh, are you crazy? I'm never going to talk to myself. But when you do, and when you are able to be soothing, comfort words replace comfort food. Because all of these addiction studies, what it really comes down to is using the food to resolve something internal.
Yeah, no, I agree totally. And thank you for that, because you made me more aware that I need to be more aware when I get triggered. And then just, you know, it helps me to take deep breaths and be, you know, present and just say, what am I feeling more than what I want to eat? It's what am I feeling? What's being triggered right now? And then try to allow that feeling to come up or whatever it is. That's a good point. I don't do that enough. My mind's so active. I need to get out of my head and into my heart more.
Oh, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Yes, absolutely. And I hear what a great friend you are to others, even hypothetical friends, right? There's a part of you that shows up for others that's curious and interested and calm. Let's talk about it. I'll be your sounding board. But when it comes to you, like you abandon yourself.
Yeah, I've got too many things going on, so I don't take the time for myself a lot of times. I'm, you know, got 10 things going on at once, and I'm in my head too much. I really am in my head too much. I need to get, you know, the key for me is to use my guidance, my intuition, and not let my head be in control. And I'm being more aware of that now, to love that, you know, love my head. It's here for a purpose to help me go through life. But for my emotional needs, I need to really pay attention to feelings, because that's what your real true guidance is.
Yes.
I need to practice that more, go out of my head into my heart and see what I'm feeling and anything intuitively that comes through for me. I think that is really where I'm at right now. And being so intellectual, I have a heavy left brain and right brain, so they fight over who's going to be in control, I guess.
Well, think about it this way. There's the logical, which is, I guess, which would be your left brain. There's your logical. And then there's the psychological, which is your unconscious or things you may or may not be aware of. And sometimes we get so good at turning to ice cream when we're stressed that we don't even know exactly what we're feeling, or what we're thinking, or what the triggers are. That's why I created this food mood formula, so that you may not realize the depth of how you're being triggered. And this way you can just cut right to, okay, obviously I have a need for comfort. People will come in and they'll say, I had ice cream, but it had to have crunchy bits in it. So I realized, it was comfort.
It's kind of like our coffee. Our coffee, you go into Starbucks, it's like, oh my God, there's one request for a cup of coffee, and the person has like 10 things they want done to the coffee.
Exactly. But if you're drinking coffee with crunchy bits, that doesn't sound too good. But ice cream with crunchy bits, people will be, so I realized the ice cream was soothing and I needed comfort, but the crunchy was my anger. I was frustrated. And this gives them, so you can have those combinations. And then it gives you a shortcut to, what do you really need? What are you really feeling?
Oh, that's very good. I like that.
I'm glad you like that. I've found that it's very helpful, because you can use food so fast. It's a friend. It helps you. It's a frenemy, right? It helps you, and it helps you de-stress. It helps you relax. It does whatever it does for you. But of course, it also hurts you. So when you can take the function of the friend and find a new way of being a friend to yourself, you don't need ice cream.
Yes, I'm I believe you're correct, especially giving attention and time to the child within, because there's so much trauma and things that have happened in the past that you just, I remind myself that I have a little kid in me that needs to be comforted, and that's so important. So,
yes, that little kid in you needs soothing and kindness and understanding, and she needs to heal. You need to heal. And then
Yes. You
can give up ice cream. See, ice cream is not the problem. Ice cream is the solution to the problem.
Yes.
But when you have the courage enough to recognize that there might be something going on that's difficult to feel, and remember, feelings are just reactions to situations. That's it. They're not character flaws. And you have a kinder response to yourself, as I even hear you doing as we're talking, a lot will change.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for this conversation. I didn't plan on this morning.
Well, surprise!
I plan on listening to a webinar, but this was fabulous. Thank you so much. You made my day.
Oh, you're so welcome. Call me back anytime. I'm here every Wednesday.
Okay, thank you. Have a fabulous day.
You too. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Well, that was a happy accident. An accidental caller. That's never happened. That's pretty cool. I could just hear how kind Jody is to other people. And I hope, Jody, if you're listening, that you just turn that lovely kindness and understanding onto yourself. So I was talking about how deprivation leads to wanting something more. I mean, how many times have you said, I'm going to go on a diet tomorrow or starting Monday, so because I'm going on a diet tomorrow, I'm just going to go crazy today and have whatever I want because I'm not going to be able to have it starting Monday and then for the rest of, you know, all time until I lose X pounds. Ugh. But when you can say, hey, I can have it or not have it, then you can choose whether you want to have it or how much you want to have of it. And when you're in the place of deprivation, that seems like an impossible dream. People say to me, I can never eat, I can never keep anything in the house. Like, are you kidding me? I can't keep cookies in the house or bread or candy or chips or anything. They're like, I'm going to eat all of it. And then cut to sometime in the future, they'll come in and they'll say, oh my God, I had to throw these bag of cookies away, like I kind of forgot it was there and it went stale. How did this happen to me? This is how it happened, by really changing the way you think about food and the way you respond to yourself. Because, you know, the function of, you know, diet mentality is really destructive. By just restricting foods, either literally not eating anything with sugar or labeling it as bad. You know, how many times have you gone out with friends or how many times have you said, ooh, I'm going to be bad, I'm going to have dessert. Really? That's being bad? I don't know. I would think robbing a bank is bad. Eating dessert, not so bad. So it creates real or perceived deprivation when you have this sense of I can't have that. And when you take away the labels and you allow yourself to have what you want and trust that you're not going to go crazy, you're not going to eat everything in sight, you will find that sort of addictive feeling goes away. And we commonly think about eating behavior as being controlled by willpower. So when you're trying to use willpower and then your willpower fails, as it inevitably will, willpower, you can't white knuckle yourself through life, then you feel like you failed as a person. And then you feel like, oh, see, you know, it's that food. I'm addicted to that food. It has a hold on me. And you feel so powerless. And it's not true. It's neither lack of willpower or addiction. It's the diet mentality that makes your eating decisions for you. I was just out of town in Yosemite and with friends, and we were at a restaurant, and we were close to the people next to me. I didn't purposely eavesdrop. It just happened. Okay. I heard the conversation. And this woman was saying, oh, I really shouldn't have that. I shouldn't have it. But, oh, it's vacation. I'm going to have it. It was like fried something. And then when it came, I could hear her the whole time. I'll just have one more. Like apologizing for it. And I thought, this woman is not enjoying her fried whatever whatsoever, because she's feeling like she shouldn't have it, so she's feeling bad about it. She's probably telling herself she's never going to have it the rest of the weekend or in her lifetime, and that just makes you feel bad, which you don't even enjoy the thing that you're having, and then you feel bad about yourself, and that's a horrible cycle to be in, especially when you may use food to comfort yourself when you feel bad. Remember, the way to respond to yourself when you feel bad is not ice cream, it's not cake, it's not chips, it's not anything, it's words and tone. So when you give yourself comfort words, when you validate, remember the acronym, VARY, V-A-R-Y, validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself. So validate, of course I'm feeling this. How could I not? Anyone in the situation would probably feel this for whatever's going on. And you acknowledge that. Yes, this is just a response to what's going on, and I'm a human being and I'm having a human reaction. And then reassure yourself, I'm not always going to feel this way. It's not always going to be like this. This is hard right now, but I'm going to get past this. I've gotten past lots of other things in my life. I can get past this. And when you over and over and over you do that, you get very used to doing that. That becomes even more powerful than ice cream or whatever it is that you're using to distract yourself from your feelings. And of course, although I always thought it went without saying, I learned otherwise, because I've had people come in and say that they tried talking to themselves and it didn't work. And when I ask them, well, what did you say to yourself and how did you say it? They'll say things like, well, I told myself, you're doing a great job, you can do this. Like as flat as can be, like as flat and disinterested and almost like grudging as can be. And I tell them, look, if you said that to anyone else as a way of reassuring them, it's going to be all right, you're okay, it'll get better, they wouldn't feel so comforted, would they? So tone is so important. The way you talk to yourself, not just the words, but the tone. When you say to yourself, you could say, it's not always going to be like this. Not so warm and fuzzy, is it? But if you say, you know what, it is not always going to be like this. It's not always going to be like this. Gives a whole different feeling, right? So that's why the way that you respond to yourself is super, super, super important. Now, another thing I want to say about our brains. Larry from Burbank, I don't know if you are listening, if you want to call in, or if anyone wants to call in and talk to me about this. The call-in number is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. Research that focuses on the brain as the primary source of behavior really ignores the powerful influences of the unconscious mind on the brain, as well as, what family, society, culture, and all the other influences that impact our development. We have to look at babies, right? They don't just have little mini adult brains. They have brains that are growing, and they are designed to optimize attachment to their caregivers. So children of depressed mothers or fathers show a disruption in the development, connection, and integration of the frontal lobes, and a decreased ability to regulate emotions. So you can see that the way that you were responded to, or the way that you felt yourself in your environment, can really affect the way your brain develops. And then if you cannot regulate emotions, everything feels like too much, then you're going to use food to escape. So I like to tell people to start thinking about a gauge. Like on a scale of 1 to 10, take sadness. You know, if 1 is, you know, you're feeling a little down, a little blue, and 10 is suicidally depressed, if you're not used to going, okay, well, maybe I'm more of a 7, and I'm sad versus I'm depressed versus I'm hopeless versus, you know, the more that you can gauge what you are on that scale, the more you'll be able to regulate what you're feeling and respond to it. Otherwise, you can get very overwhelmed. Same with anger. Particularly women are told, gotten some message either covertly or overtly, nice girls don't get mad. Nice girl, don't be angry. Don't get angry. That's not nice. And so particularly women are socialized to disavow their anger, which of course comes full force against them when they get mad at themselves for what they eat or what they weigh. Most people have no problem being mad at themselves because they ate a cookie, but God forbid they should be mad at someone who actually hurt them or upset them. And so if you think about on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is, you know, fury. 8 is rage. 7 is incensed, you know, angry, annoyed, frustrated. You can see that these are all forms of anger. If you don't allow yourself to know when you're at a 3, it can sure feel like a 10. And then when it feels like a 10, you can't regulate it, and you just need something to get rid of that feeling. And eating has sort of a sedative effect. And so often part of the frenemy is not just, it can be comfort, it can be distraction, numbing, it could express, turn painful emotions into physical discomfort. It can do so many things. One of the things that it does is it relaxes your body. So if you can't allow yourself to relax with the way you're responding to yourself, you're going to be more vulnerable to using food for that purpose. So practice kind of having a gauge for, well, what is the intensity of my feeling? First of all, what am I feeling? And how strong is it? How strong is this feeling? What is this like? And then you can try to remember other times when you felt similarly and you got past it. Here is another caller. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Nina. This is Larry from the San Fernando Valley.
Which part of the San Fernando Valley?
Burbank. There you go. I heard you talking about depression. And the first thing that occurred to me, I've had major clinical depression where it's just one hop, skip away from the hospital, that kind of thing. And what I've discovered is that whenever I'm in that moment, whether it's depression or anxiety or anger, but especially depression that day, I write that day off. But the big problem is I convince myself that depression will continue forever. And I always, you know, you get out of it, it ends. I get out of it, and it ends for me. But, you know, a month later, if I'm back into it where I'm just really, really down and I can't move, I convince myself again it'll happen forever, and it just never does. So, I'm learning now, but if I'm having a horrible day, I'll be better tomorrow, and that helps a lot.
Right. Hopelessness, that hopelessness of I'm stuck in this place when you're depressed, and it's hard to think about why you're depressed. it just feels like you're stuck in the depression box and you're never going to get out. That, of course, leads to more depression. But when you can, as you just said, remember the times that you have felt this way and it didn't last forever, you did get out of it, it can make some room for you to think about what is why is depression in your life. And my language is very specific, because when you say, well, I'm depressed, you know, I'm a big stickler for language, because language registers, our psyches are listening to our language. When we say something like, I'm depressed, or I'm a binge eater, or I'm whatever, and you identify yourself with that, it feels like it's part of your identity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm a depressed person, rather than I'm a person who struggles with depression sometimes.
Yeah. To feel like, maybe to change the mindset where I am feeling this way now versus this is my core being. That's a huge difference.
Exactly. And one of the other things you can do is to kind of externalize it in your language. Depression is trying to get at me. You know, so you create with your language a difference, a distinction between who you are as a person and the feeling.
Yeah, I've got to remember that as well. But it seems to be universal among, you know, friends who admit to this kind of thing more than the blues, that they know in their heart of hearts, down to their core, down to their double helix, this is always going to be the way it is from that moment. It's just a fallacy of the depression, I guess.
Yes, it's hard to remember when you feel depressed. It's hard to remember that there was a time that you didn't, and it's hard to have hope that you will feel better. When you feel better, it's hard to believe you're going to be depressed again. You think it's behind you.
Right. Well, that part, I wish I
not you.
Could agree with. But
right.
Not me, but you know, when I'm bad, it's hard to believe it'll ever get better.
And if we tie in sugar addiction to the depressed feeling, it might be a way. It can be a way for people, maybe you, I don't know, to try to counter, like self-medicate the depression, rather than you are addicted to the substance of sugar.
I think the quote pull of depression could be what you know may be termed the pull of sugar. I know that when I'm playing handball against the curb, as the saying goes, you're that low, it's game on with anything. It could be, you know, half gallon of chunky monkey, or maybe even some ice cream. That's what I did. But it could be anything. I'll eat anything. So.
Yeah, because you're just trying. You're trying to help yourself in a way that also hurts you.
It's, you know, as you're talking, it's an expression of self-hate as well as medication. Like, I'm worthless, you know, if my core at that time could have a voice, I'm worthless, so I don't deserve, you know, healthy food. To hell with it. Screw it. Game on. And, you know, I've had friends in a 12-step program for overeaters, which, you know, whatever, who, when this happens, they don't stop. They go for 6 months or lose their job. They eat, and they wake up one day and they're 400 pounds. I'm very lucky. After 3 hours, you know, my life goes on and I get better. So it could be a lot worse.
Yes, but I would say that those friends who go on those eating binges there's something going on that it feels like it's about sugar, but there's something going on that they're enacting through sugar, and that there's a deficit in their ability to be responsive to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
and it's got to be, go ahead, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I mean, it's got to be, you know, core psychodynamic stuff that's, I hate to compare, but is a lot worse than or they're just their reaction to it is far more toxic than mine. I get started, but I stop, and they get started, and they go and go and go. So, you know, well, I should count my blessings.
Yeah, So you're an optimist. But look, people, you turn to food for a reason, right? It's comfort, to alleviate anxiety, to distract from painful, upsetting thoughts, to sleep. Lots of people use it to just relax their bodies, to fill a void, to calm down. Basically, eating is a way of managing really difficult internal states. And if we think about it that way, it's your mind's way of protecting itself, except you're overprotected.
Yeah, that's true. And the feeling I get is like a salve.
Yeah.
When people have asked me what are you trying to feel when I go on a binge? And again, it's maybe in 2-3 hours max, not 6 months. But what are you trying to feel? And I say nothing. That's all. And that's kind of a curveball. They don't expect that.
Yeah, it's a way of dissociating.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, whatever it is, it's doing something for you. It's mm-hmm. helping you in some way, even though the help that it is providing may not be such good help. But it's often, it's like a psychic retreat, what you're describing.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend, one of those I mentioned, who was 400 pounds, who had, quote, the surgery, and he got down to about 160, but he never dealt with the psychodynamic issues, and about a year later he literally drank himself to death. So he just switched substances, which really, it reaffirms the fact that it's not about the sugar or the alcohol or the cocaine or the gambling. It's about the stuff you talk about every week.
Exactly. In fact, I had mentioned earlier in the show that the woman had posted on Facebook, hey, sugar isn't as addictive to heroin, and was chastising me basically for suggesting that there were psychological motivations. And then someone else wrote in, and she said that she had initially been on board with the whole sugar is like heroin kind of message. And she believed that made her binge on sugar. Like, there's mm-hmm. something about, it's this bad thing. I can't have it. I must have it. And mm-hmm. she just felt like such an addict, and she felt so hopeless and so awful. And then she noticed that her kids had no problem eating sugar in small amounts. And she said sometimes they ate little sugar, sometimes larger. Sometimes they couldn't care less about sugar. And she realized that she was the same way when she didn't try to restrict it. And so she started mm-hmm. having it. And it hasn't been a problem. She said, I finally feel empowered around it, sugar, instead of like a scared victim. And she said that when she was trying not to think about sugar, all she thought about was sugar. And then when mm-hmm. she gave herself permission, if you want to have it, have it. And sugar stopped being a thought.
It's like that saying, perfection is the enemy of the good. She was trying to be perfect, a good little sugar Nazi. And that was the enemy of the good, which was, hey, lighten up, it's okay, I can handle this, instead of externalizing it to the sugar.
Exactly. All of the research studies that I have read have concluded that if there is anything to be said for it, it is in terms of using it as an addiction, using that word addiction, it is an eating addiction, not a sugar addiction. So eating...
Okay.
Eating as a way of doing, in your case, dissociating or all the other things it might do, as opposed to a dependency on the substance of sugar or any other food.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned, I think, on an earlier show, and maybe not, I heard it somewhere else, that one researcher said if sugar was addictive, why don't people just eat spoonfuls of sugar? Why not just cut to the chase?
Yeah,
maybe you mentioned that.
I said it today, right? It's always in the context of some other food. And I also talked about how rats are given just sugar, and they're motivated by survival. So of course they're going to eat sugar, because sugar mm-hmm. is going to help them survive. Cocaine is not going to help them survive. So if you extrapolate from that, it's even more addictive than cocaine. That is really a false hypothesis. But sugar, yes, nobody goes around eating spoonfuls of sugar like, ooh, I got to get my fix. It's always in some kind of food.
through. The hard thing about food, and this is, I guess, neither here nor there, but if I'm going to give a cocaine, as you say, I don't need cocaine to live, but I've got to take the tiger out of the cage 3 times a day to deal with food, even though it's not physically addictive. It's just that medium that's so hard in order to survive.
But
it's like saying I have to do cocaine moderately 3 times a day to live.
But when you make, I have another caller who's calling. I'm sorry, caller, we're actually out of time on the show. I just want to end it by saying, Larry, just one thing. When you allow yourself to have whatever, eat intuitively, and it is a process to get there. I'm not saying you just flip a switch and you're just like, oh, I'm just going to have whatever I want. You've got to get mm-hmm. there by first figuring out what this binging is doing for you.
Right.
But eventually, when you don't have good food, bad food, when you just have healthy, not so healthy, what do I feel like? I'm going to eat intuitively. I'm going to also enjoy a dessert every once in a while. Then it won't be a battle zone every day. Then you'll just be able to focus your mind on other things and eat in a healthy way, sometimes not, and be okay with it. That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's how you win the diet war. That's why I call it the diet war, because people are so at war with themselves, and there's another
right.
way.
Right. So, it makes sense. It all does.
So thank you for calling in last week, and which led to my topic of today, and I'm glad that I was able to talk more in depth about why sugar addiction is not a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's our show for today. So thank you for joining me, Larry, and everyone else out there.
Okay, thank you much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so that is our show for today. I am here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio. You can also listen to the show online if you miss it on iTunes. It's the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. If you search it, you will find it. And if you like the show, please do me a huge favor and leave me a rating and a review, because the more of those I get, the more it shows up in searches and the more people I can reach and help make peace with food. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next week.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.